Hello. During my last lecture, I talked about this really fascinating civilization in Pakistan and across the border with India that archaeologists call the Harappan. As I noted, the development of Harappan civilization has a number of features that tend to distinguish it in quite striking ways from the other contemporary civilizations that we've already looked at, particularly in Mesopotamia and in the Nile Valley. The appearance of the mature Harappan period at about 2600 to 2500 BC seems to be quite abrupt, taking place over about a century. I will note that it may have been less than a century as well. This is simply the inevitable uncertainty of archaeological dating techniques, particularly radiocarbon dating. So it seems to be quite abrupt, although of course we do have to remember that this transitional period was preceded by an early Harappan phase that itself involved significant population growth, and at least some beginning phases of urbanism with population centers of 3,000 to 5,000 people. So some of the basic elements of state formation and political complexity were already there. It's not as if we can really say that the mature Harappan period simply bursts out of nothing. The economic, the agricultural basis, the all-important agricultural basis of urbanism and complex societies had been developing in this area of South Asia for thousands of years. Mature Harappan displays a variety of different characteristics, and there's this process, this fascinating process that goes on associated with the beginning of this period. Between 2600 and 2500 BC, we see, first, the destruction of occupations by fire in at least some sites of the preceding early Harappan period. We see the establishment of some new occupation centers, virgin soil occupations, in places where no communities had existed previously. And as I detailed last time, the appearance of a whole host of new cultural features, and especially, I think, urbanism as a very distinctive settlement system, settlement form during the mature Harappan period. This contrasts strongly with the more gradual cultural and political developments that we've seen in other parts of the world. There's also relatively little evidence for warfare in mature Harappan sites, in these sites between about 2500 and 1900 BC. As I noted, there may be some fortifications on early Harappan sites from before 2600 BC, like Kotiji, but little evidence on the Harappan urban sites themselves. And I will note that this viewpoint is in contrast to that of some earlier reconstructions, such as those by Sir Mortimer Wheeler, one of the first excavators on some of the Harappan sites. Sir Mortimer Wheeler saw wall features as inevitable signs of fortification. He seems to have thought that any wall indicated defense. And Mortimer Wheeler looked to later Sanskrit texts in India from the first millennium BC, the Rig Veda and related writings, for evidence of war. However, those written accounts date from many centuries after the end of the Harappan period. And I note that I'll come back to those written sources, the Rig Veda and other sources in a few minutes. And the wall system seemed to be oriented for flood control rather than from defense against external attack. There are no representations of military activities or warfare or conquest in Harappan art at all. This is, again, a pretty major distinction from what we see in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, and in Mycenaean civilization, where warfare is one of the primary topics depicted on political art, on state art, if you like. It's more akin to the relative absence of scenes of warfare in Minoan art. Moreover, the characteristics of Harappan culture seem strikingly different than those of those other contemporary states. I mentioned this last time. There's really very little evidence for the material signs of rule that we've seen in other areas. There's a relative lack of luxury goods or evidence for palaces or houses of wealthy people. It's difficult, even on Harappan urban sites, to decide where political power was exercised at all, or in what form it was exercised. There are none of the vast constructions that seem designed to overawe common people, that seem to design to remind common people of their place, relatively low place, in the social hierarchy. It's also important to remember the size of the area incorporated within the Harappan cultural sphere, within Harappan civilization in general. This is actually a fairly difficult comparison to make, given that our archaeological surveys are inevitably incomplete, and given the irregular areas occupied along river valleys in these different cases. But it's likely that sites of the Harappan civilization were distributed over an area at least 2 to 3 times as great as that of Mesopotamia or the Nile Valley. These sites are found over a large area. We can't minimize the importance of this. Harappan civilization successfully extended itself over significantly larger areas than those of many contemporary civilizations in other parts of the Old World. There's also some evidence for Harappan trading colonies situated as far away from the cultural centers as Shortagai in northern Afghanistan, for example, and possibly at Altın Tepe in Turkmenistan in Central Asia. So the reach of the trading system into areas of Central Asia that are not very well known archaeologically was quite impressive. The implication of this is that further archaeological work will probably result in a greater appreciation for a larger extent of Harappan contact in this region. In general, the extent and nature of Harappan trading systems are far less well understood than are those of, say, their Uruk or early dynastic equivalents in Mesopotamia. But it does appear that Harappan traders were venturing far away from the heartland of their civilization to pursue commerce. This in itself is not surprising. Even as far before the Harappan as the time period of Mergar, on the border of Balochistan and the Afghanistan plateau, we see evidence of artifacts, materials coming in from Afghanistan and potentially Central Asia as well. This is also the case to the west, along the coasts of the Arabian Sea. Harappan traders seem to have moved by ship along those coasts, probably from their own ports, at centers like Lothal in Gujarat, in what's now India. And Lothal is known as a fairly large Harappan port. Archaeologists have found evidence for Harappan contacts as far to the west as early dynastic Mesopotamia. Now, this seems to have involved primarily a trade in luxury goods, which in many ways is not surprising given the distances that we're talking about. An area, a distance significantly larger than that between Mesopotamia and the Nile Valley, for example. It seems to have involved Harappan beads and metal for Mesopotamian cloth, metal items, and figurines, for example. And I will note, I mentioned last time the importance of bead making in Harappan technology. It seems to have existed not merely as an export, and some of these beads are absolutely beautiful, but may well have also played a role in signaling status within Harappan society on its own. We really don't have a good sense of how this trade between the Indus Valley and Mesopotamia worked, of its extent, of the time period over which this trade took place, over the nature of contacts between the two regions. But what we do know is that the two areas were, in fact, in contact. There are even some seals with Harappan writing found in Mesopotamian sites. The dream of archaeologists and epigraphers would be to find a bilingual text like the Rosetta Stone with the same message, the same written content in both Mesopotamian cuneiform and Harappan script, which would obviously help enormously with the decipherment of the Harappan script. To this point, however, that hasn't happened, unfortunately. As I mentioned in an earlier lecture, Mesopotamian texts from this time refer to a place called Maluha, which was located far to the east, beyond the Strait of Hormuz. It appears likely that Maluha refers to the Indus Valley and thus to Harappan culture. As I said, we would like to know far more about what the relationships between these areas looked like. It would be fascinating to know, for example, if there were actually Harappan trading enclaves in Mesopotamia, or potentially Mesopotamian trading populations in Harappan cities. At this point, we don't know. How were those Harappan cities ruled? And what form did social hierarchy take on these sites? In the first place, we have to note a paradox. There's a good deal of evidence for cultural continuity and commonality in different parts of the Harappan cultural sphere. And as I noted, this seems to have developed pretty quickly. At the same time, there are also patterned regional differences, particularly between, for example, Baluchistan, the Indus Valley itself, and Gujarat. This is not the empire of uniformity that archaeologists like Sir Mortimer Wheeler spoke of. In general, there is no evidence that this area was ruled as a single large territorial state. The mechanisms of rule do not seem to have existed at this level, and there seems to be too many diverse urban centers to fit, say, an Egyptian model. All of these different towns and cities occupied simultaneously. It really doesn't look like that Egyptian model of a territorial state at all. Of course, if it were a territorial state, we would be talking about a state, as I noted, perhaps 2 to 3 times as large as that of Egypt in the Nile Valley, and much, much larger than any Mesopotamian state of the period. So it's likely, it's much more likely, that political control in the Harappan civilization existed at the level of the individual settlement, probably the urban center, the city or town. So the question then becomes, should we think of Harappan urban centers as analogous to Mesopotamian city-states, each with their individual ruler? As I noted, the archaeology does not support that idea. There's no artwork or architecture that seems to be associated with rule, and especially not with individual rule over the community. And we just do not see evidence of the depiction of rulers in Harappan art. And if those depictions are not there, in Mesopotamia, in Egypt, this is a constant reinforcement of the power and nobility and relations with the deity possessed by the ruler, by the king. There's nothing like that on Harappan sites. So it's possible, it then thus appears possible, that leadership in Harappan communities functioned quite differently than it did in Mesopotamia and Egypt. That leadership was perhaps based more upon what archaeologists call heterarchic principles, depending on multiple criteria of authority and networks of relationships and authority at generally equal levels of power. What I'm doing here then is making a relative contrast between hierarchy on the one hand, which we understand very well, and heterarchy. Hierarchy is easy to talk about, heterarchy less so perhaps. If Mesopotamia, and in some ways especially the Egyptian state, were very hierarchical, in the Egyptian case with the pharaoh understood as essentially a physical representation of the Nile Valley and the state itself, and essentially semi-divine. These are very hierarchical conceptions, with the ruler at the very pinnacle of power in social, economic, and ideological terms. Then perhaps the Harappan state depended less on hierarchy. Perhaps it depended more upon a variety of different groups at generally similar levels of power, assuming more importance. This could be more, depending on whether one wants to think about it positively or negatively, we might call this more communal rule. We might call it, perhaps with a slightly different take, more oligarchic rule, based on the horizontal spread of relations and connections among and between corporate groups. However, we should not necessarily take this to mean egalitarian or democratic rule. That's not what I'm saying at all. This may well have involved power partitioned out among a bunch of relatively powerful groups in and of themselves, but with a balance of that power existing within the society. And there's nothing to say that these different groups could not have had significant internal hierarchy. They might have been, for example, merchant guilds or religious associations. And it's notable that the abrupt reorganization of Harappan society at the beginning of the mature Harappan period seems to involve an intensely ideological element, almost an element of religious conversion. So the heterarchical rule that I'm talking about here would not involve an individual king. Indeed, balances of power among such communal groups might well be very hostile to the nature and the notion of centralized individual rule. On the other hand, I'm not speaking necessarily of some sort of communal, egalitarian democracy that we understand perhaps from later time periods. We really have some difficulty identifying, in the absence of evidence for hierarchy, what such rule would have looked like. As we're going to see, such heterarchical models have been invoked to explain processes of state formation in areas like West Africa, for example. These heterarchical models are a real departure for archaeologists, and actually probably for the general public as well. Archaeologists are accustomed to thinking about early state formation as the unimpeded march of social differentiation and political centralization, the march of hierarchy, from agrarian egalitarianism to the appearance of kings and pharaohs. The Harappan case looks like something quite different. Indeed, some archaeologists question whether we can talk about Harappan states at all. They'd prefer to keep traditional models of political evolution, and thus they prefer to designate these Harappan urban centers as individual chiefdoms run by chiefs. This does not seem to me to be very useful. The concept of an urban center containing perhaps 30,000, 40,000 people as a chiefdom seems difficult for me to comprehend. A chiefdom model in this case assumes the march of political centralization and social hierarchy as much as does the notion of the early state. It just designates an earlier stage in the process. And quite frankly, this seems to me to be more of an attempt to privilege a rigid succession of political forms from band to tribe to chiefdom to state, such that if one doesn't have a state, one must have a chiefdom. Seems to me to be an attempt to privilege that succession over the diversity of what humans actually come up with. It seems more realistic to think about states developing in and around the Indus Valley, but to recognize that political developments in this region appear to provide a strikingly different pathway to state formation and rule than those pathways taken in Mesopotamia and Egypt. Many of the Harappan settlements were abandoned at about 1900 to 1800 BC, approximately 600 years after they were originally established. Population densities over the region were at least somewhat reduced at the same time. And there seems to have been a widespread disruption in economic and trading systems in and around the Indus Valley. At this time, for example, references to Maluha disappear in Mesopotamia, and trading networks into Central Asia appear to cease for at least some period of time as well. There's a lot of archaeological debate about the degree of disruption that actually attended this period between 1900 and 1800 BC. It appears that some elements of Harappan culture persisted in certain areas for many centuries after this, especially in the Gujarat and Punjab states of northwestern India. This is especially the case for ceramics, and there's even some evidence that use of the Harappan script continued for some centuries in northern India after it had stopped being used in the Indus Valley. What it was being used for under these circumstances is unknown. So it's difficult to talk really about a Harappan collapse in the same way that we spoke earlier about the collapse of Minoan and Mycenaean civilization. Urbanism, however, did more or less disappear. Average site sizes decreased significantly after the mature Harappan period. It's perhaps better to think about this as a major change in focus of the society, a loss of urban focus, rather than to use the term collapse. Gregory Pacelle, who I noted earlier, and who sees an ideological transformation at the beginning of the mature Harappan period, between 26 and 2500 BC, sees an equivalent transformation at its end. As people, we might say, lost faith in the overarching belief system that sustained Harappan civilization. That's a possibility. Unfortunately, we don't really know what that belief system was. Although, as we'll see in a moment or two, one main issue of debate is the relationship between that Harappan belief system and ideology and later Vedic and the descendant Hindu beliefs that have been very important in South Asian history since then. This idea that the end of the Harappan period, the mature Harappan period, was a sort of loss of faith is an interesting hypothesis. But I will note it's one that's hard to test. And it's not very congenial to archaeologists in some way. We would prefer to analyze tangibles like environmental change or warfare than the subtleties of ideological change. It's in the past been suggested that tectonic activity disrupted water flow in some of the rivers that supplied the Harappan cities, but this does not seem to have been a decisive factor, and it's difficult to say if it actually dates to this time period at all. At this point, we don't really have enough information to say conclusively why Harappan urbanism and all the extraordinary cultural achievements associated with it ended after between approximately 1900 and 1800 BC. One persistent question, as I just noted, involves the degree to which Harappan culture and Harappan civilization influenced the course of later Indian Vedic culture of the first millennium BC, long after the abandonment of Harappan urbanism. We would have a gap, if you like, in the second millennium BC to explain in this case. Vedic culture refers to the first iron-using cultures of northern India, in which the religious texts known as the Rig Vedas were composed, and which provided the cultural stratum for the first developments of Hindu culture. There are some aspects of Harappan ideology and artwork, for example, the likely importance of ritual baths, the depictions of a male god that may be an earlier version of Shiva or Siva that seem to have persisted into later Hindu belief and practice. As I noted, the problem involves accounting for the centuries between the end of the Harappan period and the beginning of the Vedic period. It's of a piece with this enigmatic civilization that we still understand so little of how it began or how it ended. How did it begin? How did it end? Did it end? Did it continue in some form into the Vedic period? What were the modes of political relations in the Harappan cities and towns? What were its relations through Central Asia, and especially, I'll note, with other parts of India to the southeast? About the only way that we archaeologists can console ourselves is to note that we now know far more about Harappan civilization than was the case even 20 years ago, and we hope that that process continues. I now want to shift our focus again to look at the developments that led to states and a great civilization in an area that has long fascinated Westerners, that of China. Thank you.